Committee meeting, and I'm going to start today with a little schedule change. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 362, and we have some guests here today, and I'd like Senator Kate Brown and her guests to come forward and speak to us. Michael Mason and Olivia, I'm sorry. Welcome.
Good morning, everybody. It's good to be here with each and every one of you.
Can I ask you to please state your name for the record?
Oh, sure.
First, and then...
Okay, my name is Olivia Walulatum. I'm from the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation. I'm enrolled as Warm Springs and Wasco. And being here today with each and every one of you, I want to open up the floor and sing a small prayer song, as is custom on our reservation. I've come here to speak today on the S word and having the time extended. The reason why is when we have tried to work with the Oregon Geographical, the U.S., those names board, they kind of put a restriction on us, and they wanted to have, they didn't want us to use some of the Indian names, and because it's too hard for them to pronounce. And so it was kind of hard for us to come up with some of the Indian names, because that was one of the first things that we had done, was try to use our native language for those sites. And one of the reasons also is that there was a bill that was passed recently on the language bill for our teachers' licensing, and this has opened up a lot of positive things with our traditional language. And, you know, our young children are eager to learn the language, and we have that in our early childhood education center as well as the local school there. And we also put that in our Spiliai Kaimu newspaper. So we're really trying to get back part of the language that is getting lost. And so some of our people had thought that it would be good to put some Indian names in replace of the squaw word, and that's what we wanted to do. So I'm just, you know, in support of having this bill passed so that we may be able to work with you on changing the squaw word. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown, represent Portland in the city of Milwaukee. Thanks, Madam Chair, for your willingness to give this bill a hearing. I just want to give you a little background in my testimony. I have to apologize. It's probably longer than I like to give, but there was some technical issues on the Senate floor, and so I wanted to try and clear those up with you this morning. The bill before you today builds on the work we did in 2001. We passed that session. We passed Senate Bill 488. I think Senator Ferriol and myself were the co-sponsors of that bill. It directed public bodies that owned or leased public property, which contained squaw, which I'll refer to as the S word, to continue the use, discontinue the use of that word by January 2, 2005. What Senate Bill 362 will do is essentially remove the time period, the grace period, and requires a public body to consider a term or phrase in a language of a regional Indian tribe in the renaming process. So in short, basically it's taking longer than we had anticipated to change get rid of the S word in geographic names across the state. Oregon currently has more than 140 geographic names that include the S word, more than any other state in the country. Since we passed Senate Bill 488, a total of 7 geographic names have been eliminated, and the replacement names have been approved by the United States Board on Geographic Names. In addition, we've received replacement name proposals for 6 more geographic names. Additional time information is needed from proponents before we can take, before the Geographic Names Board can take final action on the last 6 names, and the board has made some formal requests for the information. A geographic name cannot be eliminated unless and until a proposed replacement name has been formally submitted to the Oregon Geographic Names Board for review, consideration, and recommendation, and the replacement name has been approved by the United States Board on Geographic Names, which has final authority on geographic names within the United States. Essentially, the Oregon Geographic Names Board is required to be reactive and not proactive in generating replacement name proposals. The board must rely on the general public to submit proposed replacement names. The Oregon Geographic Names Board has made a special effort to work with Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes, who are obviously most impacted by the derogatory nature of the S word. And the board has several contacts and has meetings with the various tribes, including Warm Springs, Umatilla, Klamath, Grand Ronde, Siletz, Coos, Laura, Umpqua, and Siusala. They have encouraged the tribes to submit proposed replacement names, provided them with appropriate guidelines, and offered assistance as needed. Obviously, with the new language in the bill encouraging replacement of use of native language, we're trying to give the board a kick in the seat of pants to encourage them to work even further with Oregon's tribes. Mm-hmm. And one of the board members of the Oregon Geographic Names Board is a member of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla. I think I'll just leave it that. I just wanted to share an experience I had with you last December. I had the opportunity. I was visiting with the Tribal Council, the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla, and we were just outside the reservation, and we were looking, just examining habitat restoration and some of the successful projects they've been doing. But I saw firsthand that the power that this bill will have in our communities around the state. On the particular creek we were on, the salmon were returning, the habitat was being restored, and we were standing on the banks of a creek that used to be known as Squaw Creek. It is now known as Escopa. And so we just really believe that this name change bill represents more than words we put on signs and maps, that it truly represents the future of Oregon. We think it's about sending a message to all Oregonians that the entire state belongs to all of us. So I really encourage your aye vote on this bill, and Madam Chair, I really appreciate your willingness to hear this proposal before you.
Thank you, Senator. Chair Berger and members of the General Government Committee, Michael Mason, for the record. I lobby for the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs. Of course, we worked on these S-word bills in 2001. That was a huge step forward for the tribe. So again, coupled, as Ms. Walton has said, with the Native Language Teacher Cert License Bill, it demonstrated a turnaround for many of the elders at Warm Springs, at Umatilla, and all of the tribes in the state, that this legislature is hearing the tribes and is concerned about saving the language, the languages, I should say, and working with Indian people to save their cultures. It was a huge, I think, encouragement for the elders, especially at Warm Springs. I wanted to just mention on this S word, there, I found over the years there's been a lot of confusion about the word because it starts as an Indian word in New York, and it may well be still a neutral term in New York. I don't know the answer. But to have this word on 140 places in Oregon is kind of like having the Russians come in and name your place names in Ireland. You know, it just doesn't make any sense to have something that is that foreign, and now it's come to be a pejorative term used in our great state. So I'd be happy to answer questions about that. Thank you.
Questions or comments from the committee? I feel it's only fair to tell you and the committee that your chair started out in life with a degree in linguistic anthropology.
Oh, my gosh.
I have a deep and abiding interest in native languages and them being salvaged. I got sidetracked somewhere. And as a woman, I also find the word pejorative, and therefore look very favorably on ways to get it off our map. Thank you. Thank you for all for coming in. Any further questions after dropping that bomb on everybody? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. No, good.
Thank you, Senator. Good to see you.
Insulting. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 362, and I am not going to go to work session quite yet on this bill. We will bring it back very shortly. And then I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 67, Nayan Gross. Thank you. This is, Carrie, do you want to?
I'd be delighted. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 67A changes the annual matching fund grant program for museums to a biennial competitive grant program. Historically, the legislature has had a grant program, actually since 1965, for the museums of Oregon. To help with them with their overhead costs. But a study that was done in 2002 was a joint committee of the Oregon Museum Association, the Oregon Historical Society, and the Oregon Heritage Commission evaluated the program and determined that the grant program had little impact on most of the museums because the entitlement was averaging out to about $250 a year. It was a better thought, and that group worked with the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department to look at the opportunity for a competitive grant program that would have a true impact, and specifically in the areas of related to collection and management of heritage collections and for heritage-related tourism opportunities. So this bill was requested by the Department of Parks and Recreation, and representatives of the department are here with you today to talk to you further about the bill.
Thank you. Welcome, James Hamrick and Irene Zenil. Am I close?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, James Hamrick. I'm an assistant director at Parks and in charge of heritage programs And I appreciate Ms. Fisher giving my testimony for me since I faxed it to her yesterday. But I'm here basically to ask for your support for this bill. It's been really needed for a pretty long time. When the museum grant program was created by the legislature in 1965, there were only 12 museums in the state. And the money has always been the same. It's $50,000. So in effect, given inflation, those museums were getting about $5,000 or $6,000 a year. And now that there are 200 museums around the state, and it is an entitlement program, it's not competitive. We just write checks, and this last year they were about $250. So I think the idea behind this joint effort between the Museums Association, Historical Society, and the Heritage Commission is really to try to make something have a little bit more accountability with the program, try to do a little bit better so that we can actually have real projects instead of just handing people $250 checks, which really don't do much good. For instance, even the Portland Art Museum is eligible for a $250 check, and they ask for it, even though they have a $9 or $10 million a year administrative budget and don't need it. The other thing that we did in concert with this is to put in a program option package in our 0507 budget, which has already gone through phase two budget hearings, and essentially would just push the funding up to about $100,000 instead of $50,000. And then to make sure that we take care of the small museums, we would, by rule, essentially make sure that there is a pot of money for small museums as well as a competitive pot for everybody else. So I think this is a really good idea, and I know that Irene, who is the president of the Oregon Museums Association, will have something else to say about this. So thank you very much, and I'll answer questions needed.
I'll have further testimony, then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Irene Zenev, and I am president of the Oregon Museums Association. Oregon Museums Association is a nonprofit organization, and we serve the educational needs of the Oregon Museum community. We've been around since 1978. Oregon Museums Association meets three times a year in different parts of the state, and we present programs that address the concerns of museum professionals, board members, and volunteers. We currently have over 200 institutional, individual, and corporate members, and we serve as an advocate for our membership. Oregon Museum Association members appreciate the legislature's long-standing support of Oregon museums through the museum grant program. OMA has actively taken part in the program through the solicitation of applications and appointing representatives of the museum community to participate in the grant review process. Our Oregon museums take many forms. We have, as James mentioned, some very large professionally run organizations like Portland Art Museum, while others are small, totally volunteer-operated organizations, and many are somewhere in between. All museums of any size seek funding from a number of sources in order to do their work of preserving collections in perpetuity, mounting exhibitions, educating the public about their collections, while engaging students, teachers, researchers, tourists, and members of the community. Museums support themselves through different combinations of private donations, foundation and grant funding, and sometimes government funding, including the museum grant. And as has been mentioned here, the museum grant program in the past has benefited all museums equally that applied and qualified for operational support. In the case of some of these very small institutions, these grants were the only public funds that these museums would receive. In recent years, the large number of applicants has resulted, as has been mentioned, in about individual grants of only $200 to $300 per institution. So to very small institutions, this amount of funding is significant, but to larger institutions, the amount was not. And in addition, many perceive this method of grant funding as entitlement in nature and express a desire to change the system that was considered to be outdated. In 2002, OMA met with representatives of Oregon Historical Society and the Oregon Heritage Commission to re-examine the grant program. The re-examination process by policymakers resulted in proposed changes to the system. And OMA supports these changes because larger awards will be more attractive to small heritage museums, which are prevalent in the state. There will be a measurable effect on museum programs through grant reporting mechanisms and feedback. And finally, museums may be able to undertake more significant projects if other funders are stimulated to help underwrite the projects with matching grant funds. Oregon Museums Association will do its best to promote the renewed grant program approved by the legislature, and we will continue to serve as peer reviewers and consultants to the process. And thank you so much for your consideration.
Thank you. Questions? Representative?
Any idea what the criteria might be for deciding?
Madam Chair and Representative Galizio, correctly. I'm going to defer to James on this because I haven't seen the
Madam Chair, Representative Galizio, we have a rules, grant rules and criteria, which are going to be changed. I can't say what the criteria will be. I suspect that in the same way that we do our heritage grants, which is a different program, essentially we just say the money's available. What would you like to do with it? And here's high end that you can apply for. Here's a low end, and then the Heritage Commission possibly will have gotten together and say here's the decided on the criteria.
Further question?
I have one.
Are you presupposing that bump to $100,000 in here and going to go ahead and give the small grants of the first half and have competitive for the other $50,000? Is that sort of the vision here? My problem is that these small museums that are used to that $250 every year, are they going to lose it? Are they prepared to lose it if it gets bulked into competitive grants?
Madam Chair, I believe that is certainly an accurate statement that not every person that applies is going to be able to. Some museums will no longer be getting the $250, but I think that there will be, and we haven't really decided how the money was going to be split. We just assumed that if we can get the Ways and Means to bump it up to $100,000, that in fact there is going to be some money for all, because we were going to reserve some of it for the smaller museums. But I think in the when this group got together, I think they decided that. That the program was no longer effective or accountable because we just were writing checks. We had no idea what we were basically writing the checks for. If you qualified, you just got a check. You didn't have to tell us what the money was going to be spent for. So I think we assume that the effect is going to be salutary, that eventually some of these museums will in fact ask us for projects funding instead of just a handout. And so I appreciate your concern, but I think the commission, the Heritage Commission, and the others that were consulting felt that it was time for change.
And I appreciate what you're saying, and I'm not necessarily opposing it. I think it's a better system. My concern is that about August 1st, I get a angry letter from the Polk County Museum saying, why did you cut off our funding? We absolutely needed every dime of it. it may have been much, not much to you. And I'm personalizing this, but you understand, do these people realize what's at stake here? Have they been notified? Have they been part of this process? I guess that's my concern. There's lots of small little museums, and they have a, I mean, that, you're right, $250 doesn't seem like much, but it matters if it's part of your budget, and your whole budget is only $10,000.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely correct. And the Oregon Museums Association has done its best to keep our membership, and we, many of those small museums are members of our organization because that's the only way that they receive information about museum policies and procedures, and it's an educational tool for them. And we've done our best to keep them up to date on this process as it's been going along. And I think they're well aware that this change is coming and that it's not going to blindside them. I think small museums, you know, we've been publicizing the progress of this bill to our membership, and I think they're prepared.
Okay. That is my... Any further questions or comments? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Seeing no one else, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 67A, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 67A.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 67A to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Sumner moves Senate Bill 67A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? For the record, note that Representative Esquivel and Representative Buckley are excused. So ordered. Anybody want to carry this? Any volunteers? Come on. You've been assigned, Representative Witt. You were. I was looking at you. I knew you wanted to do this.
There was just a slow...
My hand was...
I saw it.
Was it up? Come on, you guys. All right. Then I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 67A and open a work session on SJR 12. Kara?
Yes, ma'am. And I'm sure members of the... Committee, Senate Joint Resolution 12 directs state agencies to honor and support promises made in the 1855 treaty with the tribes of Middle Oregon. The bill also encourages local governments to do the same. You'll recall that we...
I opened a public hearing. I'm sorry. I'll put it on the record.
That earlier this session, we dealt with a bill honoring the 150th anniversary of the Treaty Trail. This bill is very much a companion piece to that and honors the work that was done by Joel Palmer, who was Superintendent of Indian Affairs for the Oregon Territory in 1855, and further recommends that that this, as I said, the state government and local governments honor the provisions of those treaties.
My committee assistant has informed me that I misspoke. We are in public hearing, not work session, on this bill. Thank you. Okay. We have more friends from the Warm Springs Tribe. If you'd come forward.
Chair Berger, members of the General Government Committee, again, my name for the record is Michael Mason. I'm just here to answer questions and to introduce, for starters, Chief Delvis Heath is the chief of the Warm Springs Tribe, member of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs, and he's here today to talk with you about the significance of the treaty and this resolution honoring the sesquicentennial of this great document.
Thank you. Welcome, Chief Heath. Please start with your name for the record.
My name is Dallas Heath Inner Winishak Witusa Nami Sunuti. I want to thank you for Nech Maitsky. Good morning, everybody. You've got a paper that testimony of the chief, the overseer, but I'd like to go and open up the way, my heart, the way it was told to me many times. And if you need any questions, Joel Palmer or Michael Mason here can answer everything else. Going back to 1855, we had a treaty with the United States government. There was five different bands, from the Wormsmith, Duckbush Band, John Day Band, that was way up in the Blue Mountains, and the Upper Deschutes Band was in the Bend area, Teich Band was in and the middle, and the Lower Deschutes Band was in the mouth of the Deschutes River. So we had tribes scattered, and then there were three bands from the Wasco. One was below the Dalles, as known now, and one was a little further down. One was in Cascade Locks. And the Paiutes didn't come till 1887 to 1889. And they had the Eastern Oregon Wars. But in 1855, when they were brought us together, the people from John Day were brought down. And the rest of them come on down, and they all met, and they were there for about 3 weeks, and they talked about the things that they wanted to do, and they moved us off of the land, and they continued to do the practice the way they've been practicing for centuries before. And they met and talked during the 3 weeks that they were there, and finally Joel Palmer brought them together, and he says, "Well, this is what we'd like you guys to do." And he says, "Well, if you're going to take us and move us, we're nomads. We've been moving along with the salmon, along with the things that we gather and live by." We're only here on this land for a short time, and we protect the water. Unwritten laws in the Indian way is to protect the water, protect everything on earth, because they don't want to give us life. The water gives us the life that we can't live without. And the food gives us the medicine, the roots, the salmon, medicine to go on, nourishes in our body. And we call them the brothers. The salmon is a brother. The deer is a brother. They're all animals out there that we give praise to. In the springtime, we have a feast giving thanks to the salmon that's returning in the root feast, giving thanks, and we pray, have service, and pray for the roots, hoping there'll be plenty. And our people can go out and gather them until they're after the praise and prayed on, and hope there's plentiful harvest. And in July or end of August, then we have the berries, huckleberries, we go out and gather, and we pray on them so that they're bountiful, take care of them. And that is a way of life for our people. Yet for centuries, long before, when the pioneers were coming in 1850, after 1855, then we could see. There's a lot of Indians we could take over and destroy the people that's coming. But that wasn't the way of life that we had. We don't destroy people. And when they moved us, then they moved us, and we had to go and do several things. One was capture Captain Jack, and the other one was when the Eastern Oregon Wars were, they brought the Paiutes back and put them on a reservation, took them up to Fort Vancouver, brought them back to Fort Simcoe and Yakima, and brought them back to the reservation. And then after about 5 years, the people told them, go on back to your own country. And they started, some of them started back, but there was $50 bounty on them, any Indian head. So they decided to go down to south end of the reservation, and that's where they stayed out of the way of the people till 1938 to form the Constitution and bylaw. My people didn't want it because we always had unwritten laws that we like. You write laws down and yet one word could change the law. And we have never written our laws. We continue to live by the laws that our Creator gave us when He created the earth. You take care of everything that's on there, it will take care of you. So we have always been our written laws that we didn't want anything written. So we finally start going to written. When the 1855 treaty was made, and then we had the Constitution 1938. There was also another treaty in 1865. A crooked agent was come along and he asked some of the Wasco people, not very many of them, if they would accept a payment for going fishing. And they said yes. And our people went down and told them, don't ever sell anything for money. Don't ever take anything for money. That land is not going to go anywhere. That land will always be there. They'll never sell it for money. So they were going to hang them. And they left the reservation. That was the whole unwritten laws. Anytime you did wrong, you couldn't stay. You had to leave, go out on your own. These people went to Washington and they settled over there. But the crooked agent was moved on right away. And we had that 1865 treaty, and Senator Hatfield was asking, give me five things to do. I have only 6 years, and I can. One of them was Corps of Engineers, made his promise in 1938, 36, when the Bonneville Dam was started. They'd give us 400 acres, and we only got 40 acres and in lieu of all our fishing sites, and we never got any of them, only 40 acres. Can we get more fishing sites or update the fishing site, fix them, they're run down. When the war came along, I just dropped the site, World War II, so nothing was happening. So he worked on that, and then Oregon objected to the 1865 treaty, and it was a fraud treaty. But we're here to celebrate 150 years that my tribe still goes by the Warm Spring. Five different bands on Warm Spring, three different bands on Wasco, one band of the Paiute, and we still. Some of the languages are going to be, but the Yakmo speaks close dialect to Warm Spring, because we have a lot of brothers and sisters. We're still, one brother just passed away a year ago, and his sister still lives in Celilo. She's 93 years old, so there's really proof that the lines that were drawn separated a lot of the families, but we still enjoy our old way and the way of life, and we got to change over and enjoy the rules that you make and the rules that you live by. That was what the old people lived by. In your house, in your place, you have your laws. Once you step out of the house, you're stepping on somebody's law. Once you step out of the reservation, you're walking on somebody's land. So we should respect other people's property, and we had that respect long before the coming. When the Vikings came way back, we had medals and swords and a tin hat that came. Then the Chinese come. We learned a lot of weaving from our people, but then later the other people start coming. So we learned to live by why destroy people why take people? Let us. I wish the young people could listen to what our old people used to talk about. Maybe there won't be a Columbine and Minnesota accident that they really have if they follow the laws of our old people. But I invite you. I didn't read any of this. I know you guys have it, but I hope that you guys have it. But Paimsha, we're celebrating. We find ways to try to celebrate any little anything, so that we wake up in the morning and give thanks. We celebrate. We're thankful we could see another day. So we celebrate. We have some reason to celebrate. We're going to celebrate. So we're going to celebrate the 150 years of the treaty of 1855. And we still have some of the princes that was when we celebrated 100 years in 1955 that are still around. One of them was my sister, since she just passed away not too long, 2 years ago. I wasn't able to make, but we still have other people that were there. So I welcome you to come out and learn more about our people. When you see what's out there, I think you'll have a better appreciation of the short history I'm trying to give you guys today, and really hope that one day we could tell the whole story. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. We appreciate your history lesson and that you're being here. Can I ask you your age?
What?
Can I ask your age?
67.
And you've seen a lot.
I got kicked out of high school in my junior year and had to go live. I went out and stayed with a 98-year-old man and a 78-year-old man, and I learned a lot from them.
Is that where you learned the language?
My grandmother speaks it all the time. When I went to boarding school, they told us I got punished many times after.
For speaking the language.
But my grandmother speaks it fluently. She worked for the government as a cook, and I lived with her. We had a big family. I lived with her, and she continues to teach me. And that lady, neighbor, about 15 years ago, she passed away about 10 years ago. She had cattle up in the mountain. I went up there, round them up, and I told her, "You got cows up there. What do you want me to do with it?" Jamashiksha. And I keep trying to tell her, and she said, "Wash, wash, me and Moses, and Krahwami, Mitch Matrixa. Ah, Majiksa." Now I know what she's saying. I found out later what she was trying to tell me. Continue to speak your language. If you don't, you're going to lose.
You're going to lose it.
Lose who you are. That's what's happening to a lot of our people today. They're losing really who they are because they're not learning our language.
Well, we appreciate your testimony, we appreciate your history, and we appreciate you all being here to support this. Is there any further?
Oh, yes, I just want to say a few words. My name's Olivia Walulatam, and I think what the chief had said, just given the short history, that it was really wonderful of him to share that with all of us today. This Senate Joint Resolution 12, it supports our treaty. And our treaty is it's a document that our tribe needs. It's very important to our people. Without the treaty, we don't have much. Just like other reservations, some other Indians, they don't have that treaty, and there's not much they can do. And I'm thankful that our people had the foresight to be able to sign that treaty. And we do know the area where this treaty was signed, over in the Dalles, Oregon. And we would like to, as part of the sesquicentennial, is to contact the owners of that land and to put a plaque there in honor of that treaty being signed. And so we are working with that family to see if that's possible. And Paiumsha, that means celebrating. And so every year our people gather together and we celebrate the treaty. And our people, they really want to show how honored they are to have the treaty. And so they dress up in their finery, like this bag here, this beaded bag. a lot of our people, we still own things like this that our elders passed down from generation to generation. And some of the things that we have, we don't know how old they are. But we put on our fine regalia at that time, and we dance, and we have specials. And it's a really nice time. I would invite all of you to go there. It's really special. We put up our teepees, and we just really celebrate in many ways. It's a very colorful event, and we have a parade and the dancing from the youngest to the oldest, men and females, and it's really a good time. To me, the treaty, it also means our livelihood, and as a female, it's very important because we have to go out and get those roots. And a lot of the roots are not inside of our reservation. And we have that ceded land, that 10,000 acres, a million. We go to many areas that's off the reservation, and sometimes we are not able to go in some of the areas because they're fenced off and they're private property. And so we have a hard time. But sometimes I went over the fence and just dug anyway, even though it's blocked, you know. And I've never been chased out. One time a guy just told me, well, if you want to go in there, let me know, and I'll let you in. But he didn't say where he lived at. But, you know, we are practicing our traditional ways still. And also, like, on the mountain areas in Mount Hood, we go to get our huckleberries, and we gather those. And we have ceremonies for our young folk, or the younger ones, when they have their first root digging or first huckleberry picking. And we continue on these ways, and we want to hang on to them. And we're trying really hard not to go completely into the melting pot. We want to continue to hold on to our traditional cultural ways. And this treaty here, that's how important it is, because it's a direct tie to our people and to our land. And for our menfolk, they go out in the areas that are on the reservation and off the reservation to get the deer and also the fish. And, you know, we still continue to dry our fish in a traditional way, and we still have ceremonies. We still have our Sunday washit ceremonies, prayer services. We have so many things that to offer our children in our traditional ways. And that's how important this treaty is. It helps us to be able to do those things. And it's good that, you know, we are asking also that the government help to work with us in some of these, because sometimes it's hard for us to get that help when we want to go out and do some of these traditional things in those ceded land areas. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned a situation where you actually had to go onto somebody's private property that was fell into the treaty. Are there other examples, you know, where this bill basically directs the state agencies to honor and support the promises made in the treaty? Are there other examples you could cite before the committee where those promises that were made in the treaty aren't being
well, I have upheld? Well, like I mentioned, the huckleberries. Sometimes it's hard for us to get our huckleberries because the government, where the forest area is, the U.S. Forest Service, they allow people to get the huckleberries at any time, whenever they're ripe. But our tribe, we have a feast, and we cannot go out to dig or to pick those berries until after the feast. And it would be good if the other people were able to, the non-Indians were able to do the same thing, because there's people out there gathering those berries. And I've picked right over by in Mount Hood, on the east side, where the skiing area is. And sometimes some of the women folk, they'll be driving by and they'll just be watching me pick, and I know as soon as I'm done they're going to come over there and start picking. But you know, it is hard for us to get our berries. It's sometimes we go over and then it's already picked and we don't have that much, and it takes longer to gather for to use for our ceremonies. My husband, he would go hunting, and he would go out in the ceded land area, and before he can get that deer, he has to knock on the door and talk to the owner and ask him if he could go on his land to go get that, go hunt for a ceremony hunting. And sometimes he said he gets so discouraged because they tell him no. So he has to drive to another area and then ask permission. And it's not always easy for us to get our foods on ceded land areas because we do have to get permission from the private land owners. And it would be good if they could work with our people when we try to get that food for our people. Thank you.
Thank you. Further question?
If I may clarify a little bit, Chair Berger and Representative Cameron, the treaty, of course, talks about the unclaimed, open and unclaimed lands. Those are, of course, BLM lands, U.S. Forest Service, state school lands are included in those. Most state-owned lands in the ceded area, which is basically from just around the Bonneville Dam up to Mount Hood, down the crest of the Cascades, about to the Deschutes County southwest corner, and then east and John Day and up into Blue Mountains and 15 Mile Creek back down to Columbia. So we are working with the Department of State Lands to make sure that, I mean, some of these areas have been fenced that are actually state lands too, and we're working with them to make sure people can get into those areas at the appropriate times for root gathering too. That's I think it's more of an oversight in their on their part. They haven't really thought about it until we started talking with them about it a year ago. I don't think it's a hostility at all. I think it's just they just forgot that these areas or didn't realize these areas were important.
Yeah, just to follow up, but just to clarify then, so the treaty allows access to the unclaimed lands for the things that we're talking about here. Does it restrict others' access? In other words, the situation that was cited here of somebody else that was in there picking berries in a unclaimed land, is there any restriction from those people being able to do that? There's not?
Not, you mean non-indigenous, non-members of the tribe?
Correct. Yeah.
No, it doesn't put a restriction on. It just
unless it's restricted by law, they can't do it.
Right, it can be.
There might be some things that they're restricted, i.e. from fishing, when a tribe could fish at a different time, correct?
Right, that's okay. Correct.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you.
Further questions? The celebration in the Dalles of this treaty, is that scheduled? Did I understand it's going to be in the Dalles?
The Dalles is having an event. I know Representative Dahlem is working with people at the National Archives to try to get an original of the treaty out to the Dalles around the time of the treaty negotiation, which is the June 23rd, 24th, and then the signing was on June 25th. But the primary celebration, I mean, the Dalles is celebrating. The primary celebration, of course, will be at Warm Springs. And the chief's reference to Joel Palmer looking at me was that... I don't know how this happened because it's during session, but I apparently volunteered. I have no memory of this, but I apparently volunteered to play Joel Palmer in a reenactment. So I've got to work on that a bit.
We'll see how you do. Actor in his spare time. Any further questions? Thank you. Thank you very much. You've honored us by coming and telling us history that we would not get it any other way. And we really deeply appreciate your attention to us. I'm going to close the public hearing on SJR 12 and open a work session on SJR 12.
Yes, Madam Chair. I move SJR 12 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Sumner moves SJR 12 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? So ordered. I would be willing to carry this, but I think that in light of this celebration going on in the Dalles, I will first ask Representative Dahlem if he would like to carry this as a courtesy with the permission of the with the committee, and if he for some reason can, I would be honored to do so.
Sorry?
Okay. We're not adjourned yet, gentlemen. I'm going to close the work session on SJR 12 and open a work session on the first thing we heard today while these people are still here, Senate Bill 362. Representative Witt.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 362 to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Witt moves Senate Bill 362 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any comments? Any objection? So ordered. Representative Witt, I would like to carry this, if you wouldn't mind. And with that, I will close the public work session on Senate Bill 362. I thank the committee very much for their attention today, and we're going to adjourn the House General Government Committee.